Hello, I'm Harry Bucknell. Thank you for downloading this podcast from ABF, the Soldiers' Charity. In 1895, Rudyard Kipling wrote The Eden, a ballad which emphasises the discipline and leadership are the keys to military success. At the end of the 18th verse, the great writer coined a phrase now so famous it is always carved in stone in the annals of British military folklore. "The backbone of the army," Kipling wrote, "is the non-commissioned man." It is the warrant of non-commissioned officers whose task it is to train, instill and maintain the drills, disciplines and daily routines that ensure a soldier's proficiency, be it in barracks or the field. It is they who implement, monitor and administer, ensuring that a soldier, or body of men, is sent into battle without waste of time, with minimal fuss, knowing exactly what they have to do, how they're going to do it, what support they are going to be given. There is no finer example of Kipling's great maxim than my guest for this special Christmas edition of General Talk, the monthly podcast produced by ABF, the Soldiers' Charity. And how fitting it is that he, not some cocked-hatted general in frock coat and spurs, is very much man of the moment in the British Army at this minute. Honoured personally by her late Majesty the Queen, praised openly by His Majesty the King, more often than not, the reputation of the nation rests in his hands. His duty, to ensure that complex ceremonial events, from the funeral of our late sovereign to the coronation of our King, watched by millions across the globe, are carried out to only the highest standards, immaculate to the finest detail, creating a vision splendid that even today makes Britain stand out from the rest. A spectacle of splendour, pageantry and ceremonial that is the envy of the world, symbolic of the great national spirit and enormous pride that lies within, ensuring that the men and women of our armed forces still rank amongst the finest in the world. A Shropshire man, he decided from an early age that the army was for him. "What a good decision it was," he told me. "I've never looked back." Joining the Chiltern Guards in 1988, he has served throughout the world wherever the army has been operational over the last 34 years. Appointed Regimental Sergeant Major of the 1st Battalion Chiltern Guards in 2010, later became the Academy Sergeant Major of the Royal Military Academy Sandhurst, then the top dog, before taking over as Garrison Sergeant Major London District in 2015, following in the hallowed footsteps of great men like Tom Taylor, Barry Mason, and his predecessor, Billy Mott. A towering figure in his own right, my guest is, of course, Warrant Officer Class 1, Andrew Vern Stokes. We met in his office at headquarters London District, overlooking the Horse Guards Parade. We start our conversation, not surprisingly, at the beginning, in 1988. I hope you enjoy the programme.
1988, a lad from Madeley. Here he is now. Did you ever think you'd get here?
No, of course not. And even now, I pinch myself and wonder how it all happened. So it's a long journey from Madeley. I didn't really have a privileged childhood. I was, you know, we were very poor, split family, and as soon as I could, I was keen to leave home because I didn't see, you know, a great future there, and gosh, what a good decision it was, because I've never looked back.
So May 1988, you turned up the Guards Depot at Purbeck. Why the Guards Depot? What was the attraction about the Chiltern Guards?
So my parents had split up when I was at an early age, and then my mother was dating a gentleman called Percy B, and he'd been a Chiltern Guardsman. He'd served 6 years and had fought in Malaya, and he kind of became my surrogate father. He was a wonderful person, sadly no longer with us. But it was his tales of being a coal streamer that really put me on that track. And I was absolutely focused from the age of about, I don't know, 12 or 13, that I was going to join the Coal Stream Guards.
Purbeck, the Guards Depot, knows this was a centre of great excess. What was your first impression when you arrived at the depot?
Well, it was a shock of capture for a start, because... because your feet didn't touch the ground, and that And that experience lasted for weeks and weeks. And I remember going home on my first bit of leave, which was probably 8 weeks after I arrived at Purbeud, and wondering what on earth had happened, because it was just battle furious. So I was made to work long hours. I was made to work harder than I'd ever worked before. I was made to run up and down hills and shoring kits and, you know, do drill all day long. And it was taking me completely out of my comfort zone, but also giving me a purpose, and I loved it. I absolutely really enjoyed it.
Many people say that drill is a bygone activity, average date, old-fashioned. Do you think that all that time on the square put you in good stead for your operation experience after Northern Ireland, Afghanistan, Iraq and Bosnia? Do you think it set you in good stead?
I think performance on operations is inextricably linked to preparation beforehand. And I think drill... I really worry about the future of drill in the army, because I don't think we do as much as we should do. But by doing drill, you learn a lot of the basics. You look after your kit. You treasure your kit. You polish it until you can see your face in it. You want to be the best you can be on the drill square. It's an exercise in teamwork. You are working for the collective and not for the individual. If you are the instructor, you are exposed. You are the only person in front of a group of 30 or even more, or in my job, thousands. And there's no hiding place. So you've got to be on top of your game. You've got to be master of what you're doing. So therefore, I think drill and everything surrounding drill offers very valuable lessons, which you can then take on operations. And you wouldn't go on patrol ill-prepared, and drill teaches you that when you go into drill square, if you're teaching drill, you've got to prepare for your lessons. You don't know what you're talking about, because when you're in front of all those people, there's no hiding place.
You are unique in the British Army. You look at the badge on your arm, the big badge on your arm with the four chevrons below it, gift of the Majesty of the Queen to Garrison Sergeant Major Mott for the Golden Jubilee celebrations as a mark of the service of the Garrison Sergeant Major on the district. You have been Academy Sergeant Major, the top dog. You have been Sergeant Major, the first time coaching girls. You've served in operations throughout the world. What changes have you seen in the Army today, and how do you think the Army is performing today, as it was when you first joined in 1988, 34 years ago?
Well, the Army was much bigger in 1988, and therefore, although it was very busy in terms of operations and predominantly in Northern Ireland at that time, there was a lot of soldiers to do the work. And now we've got a much smaller army, going down to 72,000 in the not-too-distant future. But particularly where I sit now, especially in Linwood District, the output hasn't changed enormously from 1988. And we're asking our soldiers to do a lot more and to work a lot harder to maintain those outputs, in my view, now than we ever did in 1988. I also think we expect much more from our soldiers. I said about being in front of a squad on the drill square, there's no hiding place. There's no hiding place for soldiers today because of social media. If they do anything wrong, they are quickly highlighted for doing that. So they're never really off duty. And we're asking them to use kit and equipment, which is far more advanced than I ever saw in 1988. We're asking them to be more intelligent, emotionally intelligent as well. And we're expecting a lot more of them. And I'm always incredibly proud when I see our young soldiers performing to the best of their abilities, because, in my opinion, they're far better than I ever was in 1988.
You have, as Garrison Sergeant Major, you have delivered the funeral of Duke of Edinburgh, and on the 8th of September this year, the whole world changed. You had no early indication or early warning, maybe an hour or so before, that Operation Honour Bridge was going to be called the funeral of Her Majesty the Queen. And for 11 days thereafter, you were intricately involved in a way that nobody else was involved in that. Someone close to me wrote a proper eye for detail, always respectful and always on top of the job. Those 11 days must have been incredibly pressurised. What was going on through your mind when you heard that Her Majesty the Queen had died?
I was shocked, just like the rest of the world. I was shocked because, you know, we saw her the day before meeting the Prime Minister. Yes, in hindsight, Her Majesty looked frail, but hindsight is a wonderful thing. And I think everybody expected that Her Majesty was going to live for a lot longer. Nobody really expected her demise to be so quick. So it shocked. But I was, and the team from Horse Girls, were very well prepared. You know, we've We've helped write the plan for an awful long time. I've been in this job for 8 years, so I think discreetly I've probably rehearsed most of the serials that we had to go through in 11 days. So I went into it with a lot of confidence, but also knowing that it was going to be incredibly hard work. And there was two tiers of tempo in operation. So most of the people who were taking part in the funeral were only taking part in probably one of the events, of which there were many. And we saw lots of events in Scotland. And then when Her Majesty returned to London, there was so many events that surrounded that. Yet there was a small team of people from this headquarters that were involved in all of the events. So the tempo was just relentless. And I wouldn't have been able to operate effectively if it wasn't for my fiancée, Sue. We had a deal struck that I said to her, when we find out Her Majesty has died, if indeed it happens on my watch, then you must go home and leave me in London, because I'll need the space to concentrate fully. And that was the deal. And then to my surprise, when I rang her up and said, look, Her Majesty has passed away, please can you go home? When I eventually got home that night, 2 o'clock in the morning, Sue was sat in the flat, having tracked me on the iPhone, made me dinner, made me a cup of tea. And of course, I hadn't eaten or drunk all that day. And she said, I'm not going home. I'm going to stay here and look after you. And I'll follow you around London, drop you off clean shirts, sandwiches and a flask, because otherwise you won't eat and you won't look after yourself. And also my orderly and driver, Corporal Flint, is a single parent. And he relies on his parents to do childcare. But they were on a long holiday in Spain, so they had no childcare provision. So Sue, bless her, as well as running around London at Windsor looking after me and Corporal Flint, she was also doing the school run for his kids and looking after his kids until he got home after midnight and then took them to school in the morning. So we just could not have done it without Sue. So shock, tempo, but then we got on to being focused, absolutely focused very quickly.
Of course, you talk very fondly of Sue. Her story is also quite unique. Do you want to tell us about how you came to be involved with it?
Sue has been connected to the Coldfield Guards for a long time, probably more than 20 years. She was married to a very fine man called John Aymer. He was a sergeant, but he was sadly killed in Afghanistan in 2009. And shortly after that, I took over as a regimental sergeant major. In that job, you would go and look after all the bereaved families and ensure they're okay, and they had regiments around them. 3 or 4 years later, Sue and I became an item, because we're now engaged to be married, which is wonderful. But she's been through the mill as well.
Have you set the date yet?
Not quite yet. Sue always jokes that she'd like to get married on the second Saturday in June. But of course, for those that know, that tends to be the birthday breakdown. So quite busy.
We just heard Big Tim sounding in the background that morning of the 19th of September earlier this year, when you stood in front of the nation and you stepped off the funeral procession. What was going through your mind that morning?
I was determined to be in the moment and not be process driven. How do I explain that? It's easy when you're involved in these occasions just to be absolutely frantic and worried about what could possibly go wrong. But at that point, we were 11 days into an operation, which we had rehearsed significantly every aspect, and what possibly could have gone wrong probably did on the rehearsals. I was fairly confident that we were going to be okay. So I really wanted to be in the moment. So as I stepped off the procession, and His Majesty the King was literally feet behind me, I was incredibly proud. And actually, looking back at it, I was reflecting on this 16-year-old and left home from Shropshire, and on that day was instrumental in one of the, you know, the largest days the nation's seen.
Her Majesty the Queen has recognised you as a member of the Victorian Order as a gift for the work you did for the Duke of Edinburgh's funeral. Looking ahead, the King remarked again how lucky we were to have you as garrison sergeant major. Endorsement few will ever receive, and you must be so proud of, as you say. Looking ahead, 5,000 men and women on the funeral procession, maybe 10,000 on the coronation coming up. What are your thoughts about the great day coming ahead?
I'm excited about it, and I'm in the throes of writing the plan. Last week, we briefed the palace of three courses of action, and those three options will go forward to the King quite soon, and he will give us direction on how he wants us to expand and deliver the coronation next year. But I feel the nation will get behind the King. They certainly have done already, and I think it will be another momentous national day, which will be a fantastic experience.
Now, of course, looking to other aspects of the job is also delivering great events like Festival of Remembrance at the Royal Albert Hall with the Royal British Legion, our sister charity. You're a BAFTA nominee. In fact, as I look up here, I can see your BAFTA. Can you tell us, how did you actually get a BAFTA?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's incredible, isn't it? It's surreal. The Festival of Remembrance is a real special event for me, and I call it an event, but I don't necessarily mean that. It's really significant. It's really poignant. And I was made to watch the Festival of Remembrance by my mother as a young child every year without fail. And she could tell me who the Garrison Sergeant Major was because he's instrumental in delivering that event. And then my mother passed away in 2015, but it was 2 weeks after I delivered my first Festival of Remembrance. And I know that she watched it from her hospice. So the Festival of Remembrance is significant for me. And Sue, bless her, a year after her husband passed away, was killed in Afghanistan. She led the bereaved families down the steps in 2010. So since 2015, she's accompanied me on the rehearsals on the Friday and on the Saturday morning. And when I go and brief the bereaved families and tell them what to expect and assure them that the nation is behind them and they feel incredibly proud about what they're doing and representing, Sue then stays with them for the rest of the day and gives them comfort and guidance and tells them what they're going to experience. So the Festival of Remembrance is incredibly important. And then, of course, I've been nominated twice for BAFTA for the Festival of Remembrance.
And I think you were picked by Strictly.
I got picked by Strictly from then, so I've never watched it since. But this year, the BBC got in touch and said that we'd like to nominate you for BAFTA Craft Award for your involvement in the Festival of Remembrance, the coordination of it and the choreography. And to my surprise, I went along to the BAFTA Award ceremony. And to my surprise, we beat Anton Deck Saturday Night Takeaway, The Masked Singer, and Strictly.
Oh, he's so surprised.
I couldn't believe it. So I'm now the owner of a BAFTA, believe it or not.
Well, I'm sure it's well deserved. We are surrounded by all the paraphernalia of a foot girl's version of South Major. What do you think of the qualities that it takes to be at the very top of your trade, as you are right now, one of the senior soldiers of the British Army?
I thank the Army, first of all, for giving me the qualities to get to this position, because the Army gave me all the opportunity and all the skills to be able to deliver at this level. But I think what you need is, you need a focus, you need the experience from all those operations that you mentioned beforehand, and all the events and seminary activity that I've taken part in, and of course being the Academy Sergeant Major. That all of those jobs give you confidence, and you have to have the confidence, one, to believe in yourself, and also the confidence that, you know, you can get people to the level where they can deliver the highest standards. And it's all about pride. Our armed forces are ordinary people doing extraordinary things on a daily basis. And when you get them to display that in terms of ceremonial activity, it really is a wonderful thing. So it's a case of trying to get the best out of everybody. And that's not that difficult in my job, because when we come to deliver ceremonial activity, especially things like Her Majesty's funeral, everybody wants to do the right thing and everybody wants to be on top of their game. So it's not an easy task, but you don't have to motivate people too much.
The non-commissioned officers, the warrant officers, the backbone of the British Army. And for the last 450 years, we've had a system that has been tried and tested. Do you think that that the Command Sergeant Major system, which runs parallel to that, is it bedding in well, or do you think at a time when change could be made and cuts can be made, it could be done without?
Well, I think there's some merits in having that additional command structure. I just don't think the Army is using it to the best of its ability at the moment. So, I mean, I'd just like to see how it develops. And of course, when I was the Academy Sergeant Major, we didn't have an Army Sergeant Major. I was indeed the Army Sergeant Major. So if CGS was heading over to the States for a visit, then I would go and accompany him. And I absolutely loved that. And I felt that the Academy Sergeant Major was probably the right job to be the Army Sergeant Major. But I get the merits of having a dedicated Army Sergeant Major now, because there'll be other aspects where you just wouldn't be able to give the time when you're trying to do two jobs. And I know the current Army Sergeant Major is doing a wonderful job and is taking that role forward. So I think it's still early days. We're only on the third or the fourth term of the wheel. But I think with time, we'll understand the merits and we'll get to use that system much more effectively.
Now, forgive me for being a bit casual and relaxed with you, Garrison Sergeant Major, but off duty, Vern. He likes to run a marathon. In fact, he ran a marathon not long after the Queen's funeral. What else keeps you when you get back to Sue late at night and you you throw off those your 30 study polished boots and you say, get your house out of business, star slippers on, and you say, right, love, what are we going to do tonight? What happens off duty?
Well, I love London. I adore London. You know, I try and make the most of it. I try and explore London as best as I can. It's such a vast city that I've lived here for 8 years, but there's still swathes of the capital that I've not seen yet. So we do a lot of exploring. We enjoy the theatre. We have a house in Shropshire, which I love going home to, but I just don't get the opportunity to go there very often. In fact, last year, I think we only made it about 6 or 7 times weekends to get back. So that's always nice. But we are avid walkers as well. We have a very fit Labrador that likes to go and do 12 or 14 mile walks or whatever. So it's about being outdoors. I don't like being cooped up indoors. I have a motorcycle. I don't ride it very often, but I like the fresh air. I like the thought that I have that opportunity to go out and motorbike if I want. So it's anything outdoors, really. When the sun's out, we do quite a lot of stand-up paddleboarding. I'm not very good. Sue's much better than I am. So that cheers her up enormously.
You've done a lot of outreach work, too. When you first began to share the job with Billy Mott, as he was handing over before he went to the United States, you did a lot of work with unprivileged communities. Can you tell us a bit about that?
So the handover for the garrison sergeant major needs to see the whole annual ceremony events. So I finished as the Academy Sergeant Major. I went and did my late entry officer's course, and then I came to London for about 14 or 15 months to shadow Billy. But that's not a full-time job. So I did the staff officer's job in the engagement cell, and my job was youth engagement across London. And we hadn't established that process, so it was a case of establishing a new job. But what it taught me was London is fast, and there's lots of underprivileged youth in London, and my job was to link them with the military and try to give them some exposure, whether it was with the Army Reserves or the cadets, or just go to talk to them and to understand them a bit. But what it did, and I benefited an awful lot from it, was it made me understand the London footprint, because here we are in Horse Guards, and it's golden, and the Mall's not too far away, and there's a National Parade Square directly out of our window. But I saw the other sides of London. And it made me appreciate what London was all about and how it actually worked. So it helped me enormously in understanding what I was to do and what London was all about and what makes it tick.
You talk about this other side of London. And of course, a huge amount has been done, Operation Teamwork and so on, to make the eye more inclusive, to bring people in. But there are whole swathes of the country that we don't reach out to, the minority communities and so on. How do we get them into the armed forces?
Well, I think it's about time. You know, we've got lots of immigration. We've got lots of diasporas across London and across the country. But not necessarily the army would be their first choice for employment. And I think, you know, given time, and as we see the generations develop and these communities get wider and more integrated with society, I think the armed forces will find it much easier to reflect society as a whole. But I think it's all about time. And if you push too hard, then you tend to alienate yourself, because if people aren't willing to join the armed forces, then they're just not going to do it. But all we can do, and we do a very good job in London actually, is send our engagement teams out, and they give talks about what the armed forces does, and that's, you know, it's a very soft power, but it's creating an impression, and it's sowing that seed, hopefully, so that future generations can see the benefits of being a member of the armed forces.
Do you think the day will come one day when we have a female garrison sergeant?
I don't see why not. I don't see why not. I was asked that question last night, actually. At a dinner. We're not close to it, because the infantry have only recently, over the last few years, opened up the doors to females. So to be in this job, you need the whole raft of experience from a full military career. So that's probably 22, 24 years before you could be appointed as a garrison sergeant major. So we're at least 20 years off, but I don't see why not at all. There are some fantastic females across the army doing excellent work and much better than many male counterparts. So, yeah, I look forward to that day.
Garrison Sergeant Major, it is Christmas, and we all think of our family and friends at that time. What's your message for the Army and for ABF over this special period?
I think to the ABF, thank you for what you do in supporting our soldiers and our veterans community. You're doing outstanding work. And when the time comes, have a relaxing and welcome Christmas break. And for the armed forces, I said it earlier on, ordinary people doing extraordinary work. In my mind, you are all extraordinary. You work incredibly hard. For you, when Christmas comes, whether if you get a chance to spend it at home, well done. If you're on operations, stay safe. If you're on duty, I hope leave comes and you enjoy it shortly afterwards. But have a wonderful Christmas and look forward to next year.
And from all of us here at ABF, the Soldiers' Charity, Gareth Sutton, Vernon Stokes, very happy Christmas. Thank you for my guest.
And my thanks once again to Gareth and Sergeant Major Stokes for being my guest on the programme. If you'd like to learn more about the work of the Soldiers' Charity or take part in its many events, whether actual or virtual, please visit our website, soldierscharity.org. Of specific note, I'm bound to remind listeners that Operation Bletchley Winter, our award-winning code-breaking challenge, is almost upon us, starting on the 1st of January. Great opportunity to burn off the excesses of the festive season, try your hand at code-breaking, explore the great outdoors, and learn more about the incredible men and women who took part in the Second World War. Visit soldierscharity.org and type Operation Bletchley in the search window. Registration costs £15. Proceeds help support the work of ABF. And finally, on behalf of everyone at ABF, the Soldiers' Charity, wherever this may find you, on operations, on duty, on leave, or at home with family and friends, I wish you a very happy Christmas and great good fortune for the year ahead. Festival, composed by Leroy Anderson, was played by the band of the Grenadier Guards. With editing by Steve Campbell and Creative Radio, this has been a Game Community production for ABF, the Soldiers' Charity.